This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support. Matt Doyle is producing, and thank you to Julie Baxter Payer and to Stephanie Regal for doing superb work the last 2 days. I was gone at a conference, and I'm back, and good to be with you. Your number is 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. Jim Donilon is here. He comes a few times a year, the insurance commissioner. He's served in that role since 2006, so 15 years now, actually in his 16th year, which makes him the longest-serving statewide official, correct?
Indeed, it is. And I was, at the time, the first Republican statewide elected official at the time.
Well, the first in that cycle.
Yes.
And now everyone is a Republican except for Governor John Bel Edwards, who will be with us today at 2 o'clock.
Oh,
so
really?
Don't miss that, his monthly show. I'm sure you'll have a lot to say about the president's pause, halting Joe Biden's pause on new oil and gas leases. And so that'll be a topic for Governor John Bel Edwards. And Jim Donilon was in the state legislature for almost 19 years, correct?
Yes, sir.
Isn't that something? You will have been the insurance commissioner as long as you were a state lawmaker
Indeed.
By the time you're up for reelection. Are you running?
I am running. Why not? I enjoy what I do. We've made an incredible difference over the past 15 years and have a real good reputation. I'd call it an excellent reputation for our insurance market nationwide, despite our many challenges, the most obvious of which we'll talk about here today. But yes, I do intend to run again. I feel great. My health is good. And I have a great staff around me, which I'm in the process, frankly, Jim, of rebuilding as we are going through a wave of retirements, which is common across the country because in the 90s, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners launched an accreditation program. Whereas if your state doesn't get accredited by passing certain solvency required laws, model laws, and staffing to certain levels and performing to certain levels, as judged by a peer group of our fellow states, then your state will lose its accreditation. Some have over the years. And your domestic companies, Blue Cross, Pan American, that do business, Gray Insurance Company, in other states will not be allowed to do business in those other states if their state regulation system is not accredited. And so in the 90s, when that went into effect, we staffed up. The then commissioner hired the first actuary. He's retiring at the end of this month, our chief actuary, my right-hand guy, Rich Piazza. Great asset. Started in the department back in the 90s and is reaching his retirement date here at the end of the month. That's happening throughout our department because we staffed up to meet mm-hmm. those accreditation requirements, and many other states did at the same time. So we're transitioning to a new, younger, brighter, better educated even staff that will welcome aboard and teach them what we know and go forward with them.
As mentioned, your number is 877-217-5757. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services is our underwriter, the signature sponsor for this program, and you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. And we're going to talk mostly, obviously, about insurance. And the hurricane season started June 1st, and there is a bad moon rising. We're going to get a ton of rain this weekend. But Jim Donilon, the first question is from Tracy at the Capitol, and this is one that you being a political enthusiast and historian would, I'm sure you've thought about, and it is worth mentioning that almost all the elected officials now in Louisiana statewide are from South Louisiana. You remember a day?
Oh, yes.
When
couldn't get elected if you weren't from North Louisiana.
And a Protestant, right?
And that's
now
right.
It's all, well, not all, but mostly South Louisiana Catholics.
It is, and the population shift has brought that about, no question, together with mobility. And the interaction, you know, my departed friend who was Speaker and President of the Senate, John Hankel, said that the partisan divide in the Capitol really started with the interstate system and the ability of legislators from Lake mm-hmm. Charles and Lafayette and Metairie and New Orleans and beyond mm-hmm. to commute to and from sessions, as opposed to coming to Baton Rouge and hunkering down at the Capitol House or out at the what was Airline and I-10 or Florida, the big spread out hotel.
Airline and I-10.
I-12.
Belmont.
Yeah. Belmont. Yeah. With the big oil painting of Warren Rabb.
I miss the
Billy
Belmont. Yeah.
I miss it as well. Spent a lot of time there in my before elected days as an assistant parish attorney for Jefferson Parish, working with our delegation and spending the weekdays at the Belmont, where there was every evening a cookout. Conway LeBlue from Cameron Parish would hold forth and cook for everyone living in that that complex, which had an iconic painting. I have a picture of it in my office of Warren Rabb and Billy Cannon stopping Griffin. Was it
the Wade Elmore? Was that the
it was Elmore, the backup quarterback?
The goal
Elmore.
Line stand.
Yes. The game. The play that really won the game
might have been Jake Gibbs. It was Gibbs, of course, was a guy who punted to Billy Cannon, but
yes.
I think it was Wade Elmore.
I think you're right.
7-3, October 31st, 1959, when Jim Donilon was a lad of 14 and I was a lad of one. But I remember I was in the stadium, as were a million others that night, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, and Mallory, another. Inquiry independent of politics, but Jim Donilon is a guy who rolls with the flow, asking your remembrances of former Governor Buddy Romer. You were in the legislature. He was an interesting cat, wasn't he?
He sure was. And I remember my wife and I driving to the Capitol for Inauguration Day and saying, as we did, how surprised we were that Buddy Romer was being sworn in, but how, her words, it was probably in the interest of the state to elect someone like him, so bright and talented and energetic, to create a new start for Louisiana. He tried and had some success, no question about it. I'm sure you know, but he was one of three Ivy League educated governors in Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana serving at the same time with each other.
And all Democrats at that time.
Absolutely. Yep.
And, Ray Mabus, Bill Clinton, and Buddy Romer. And Romer thought he was going to be the one to be elected president. He was a man of great confidence.
Oh, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And tragically, he was distracted, if you will, from his agenda by the failed statewide vote on tax reform.
Tax reform, yeah. April 30th, 1989. Yeah, that was the beginning of the end, as it turned out. But he would have defeated either Edwin Edwards or David Duke in a runoff. He just didn't make the runoff.
Correct.
In fact, he would have won easily.
Absolutely.
And he would have been remembered as a popular governor. But because of that indignity of losing to Edwards and Duke, that tarnished his legacy, and I think unfairly.
No question. And my personal experience with him was a Quixote effort on my part to run for the U.S. Senate with $300,000 of campaign funds against the sitting senior Democrat from Louisiana, who had $6 million in the bank.
Who would not debate you.
And for good reason. I mean, why? Why
well, you
debate
you've
someone
always
like
debated. You debated your
I did.
Mr. Temple.
Yeah, I did.
I think the voters deserve that. But
I agree.
But you have political consultants saying don't do it because, obviously, you're a seasoned guy. You would have fared well. And you would have fared well because you would have been equal or maybe even a little better, and the expectations for the challenger are usually lower.
Correct.
And you would have gotten more votes as a result of being
But not enough more.
Well, no. At that time, hard to believe we were a Democratic state, but we have evolved into something other than that, and Jim Donilon was a Republican before Republicans were cool.
And Buddy Romer did me the high honor in 1998 of going to the Republican convention in New Orleans at the convention center and placing my name in nomination for the U.S. Senate in that year, and worked with me on a daily basis throughout that campaign, starting my morning every morning with, You the man, Donlin. I wasn't the man for that campaign, but he was a good friend and someone who I have the highest regard for and fondest memories of.
Now we're going to get some bad weather this weekend, not hurricane force, but it looks like it's going to be a wet weekend. And you are an advocate of flood insurance. You have been. And right now, it's important for people to get their affairs in order.
No question. Baton Rouge area suffered greatly in 2016 from the flooding event that just sprung up on a Friday and gave us 2 days back-to-back of 10-plus inches of rainfall and inundated homes and businesses throughout the area. Only 12% of residences at that time had flood insurance in place. Today, it's 23-24%, which is great, but not enough. And that's my first advice every hurricane season: access the still significantly subsidized National Flood Insurance Program.
We'll be back with Jim Donilon in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757 for Jim Donilon, insurance commissioner for 15 years now in his 16th hurricane season as our insurance commissioner. And he came on right after Hurricane Katrina, which affected much of the state, including Jim's home territory. And I suspect your house even in 2005 got slammed. And before we go to the phone lines, and we do have some people waiting in line, another listener, this actually is Tom on Blue Bonnet, asking about some people in New Orleans in particular, on Lake View, where you hung out as a kid, as did I, although I was from Gentilly.
And I was from Mid-City.
But a lot of these people, the houses go through generations, and people don't pay insurance because they don't have to. The house is paid for. That's not a good idea.
Not at all. Most folks, their biggest asset in their portfolio of assets is the equity in their home. And they take it for granted, think it'll always be there. Their mom and dad own the house, and it's been theirs for their whole life. That happened a lot, even more so in the Lower Ninth Ward. And those folks had homes that had been in the family for 100 years and had so many different owners. If you tried to do a succession and give everybody their proportionate share, it was hundreds of folks. And so it made it impractical to rebuild. But if you have insurance, the insurance proceeds rebuild the property. You don't have to go through succession. Flood insurance, for example, is, I say, every hurricane season at the outset is the best insurance buy any property owner anywhere in our state can make, still subsidized significantly below the actual actuarial cost by the federal government.
All right. And I promise we will go to the phone lines, but we're getting some calls on a listener in New Orleans. Ray asks about the French Quarter, which is the highest part of the city. If you live there, do you need flood insurance?
Absolutely.
Anywhere
in the state of Louisiana. The levees on the Mississippi can break. They're fixing the last weak spot, low spot, as we speak, because the river has dropped to allow them to bring the equipment in to put the removable gate where the Corps of Engineers is headquartered in uptown New Orleans on Chapatula Street and protect the French Quarter, uptown, the university section, all from floodwaters that otherwise would be a great threat to property owners in our state.
David in Atlanta. David, you're on with Commissioner Donilon. Hi, David.
Good. You know, in South Louisiana, hurricane-prone Louisiana, and that's why I'm in Atlanta. I lost my home in Katrina. Say you have a $200,000 home, maybe $100,000 casualty insurance. Commissioner, isn't the deductible about 10% of the $100,000 or is it 10%, say, of the value of the home? But if your roof comes off in a hurricane, you're facing a catastrophic amount of payments before even a penny of the insurance kicks in.
No question about it. It's called the named storm, hurricane, or wind and hail deductible. Different companies call it different things, and you're exactly correct. It's not 5%. It's not 10%. Not many policies offer that high of a deductible. But the typical named storm hurricane or wind and hail deductible is between 2 and 5%. About 25 to 33% are that high 5%, not of your damage. It's 5% of your insured value. Typical homes insured for $200,000, 5%, $10,000 out of pocket before your coverage kicks in to repair damage caused by a hurricane, named storm, or wind and hail event.
All right, another listener. This is, I think it's Allie in Lafayette asking about if you have, independent of your home, let's say you have artwork, you have jewelry, you have things that could be affected by a flood, should you make an accounting of that just in case?
Positively. First off, the typical NFIP policy comes with $250,000 insured value for your home and $100,000 of insured value for the contents therein. My agent, who's now deceased, but I'm working with his son now, second generation agency, my neighbor down the block, when I was buying coverage for either my home or my flood policy, I asked him if I needed, it was my home, the $250,000 of contents coverage that came with the policy. He said, Jim, I've never had in my decades as an agent a total loss situation. Fire, many of the flat roofs in mm-hmm. our area of Metairie collapsed during Katrina and Rita, making for a total loss against the homeowners policies. I've never had a total loss that didn't exhaust what the policyholders thought was much higher contents coverage than needed. It almost every time exhausts that. And to protect that, walk through your house with your cell phone, take pictures of your flat screen TV, your carpeting, your sofas, your dining room set, and any jewelry or artwork you have as well to document what was there before the big loss.
Ray in Prairieville. Hi, Ray. You're on with Commissioner Donilon.
Thanks for taking the call, Jim. Just a quick question for Mr. Donilon. How can we put pressure on the legislature to go ahead and open up the Bayou Manchac to the Amite and the Amite down to Lake Mirepoix to lessen the damage of floods here in Baton Rouge?
No question, that is a critical project. Congressman Graves has been at the point of that even before his time in the U.S. Congress when he was at CPRA as its executive director, and he has been putting in as much pressure as he can bring with his allies like Senators Cassidy, Kennedy, and Whip Steve Scalise from my area, because it is critical to protecting property in Louisiana. Back to Richard Baker's days as chairman of the House Transportation Committee when I served with him. But frankly, it's a federal issue that FEMA and the Congress have to address. The mm-hmm. legislature really doesn't have a voice in that decision.
How was the session as far as legislative issues?
I got to tell you, Jim, I am cautiously saying this because you know how there are snakes buried in conference committee reports at the end mm-hmm. in the last days. This is my best session. We had a package of 20 bills, 15 of which were technical corrections, and those all passed easily. But we passed four things that were really, really, we passed three and got an amendment added to the budget. First off, our emergency powers were solidified in statute form after being handed to us or delegated to us by former governors Blanco, Jindal, and John Bel Edwards in each emergency situation. Last year, for example, at the beginning of the pandemic, Governor Edwards delegated mm-hmm. for insurance purposes his power. I was able to protect folks from being canceled or non-renewed in the immediate aftermath and for 3 months thereafter. Breathing room is what I call it for businesses and homeowners to get their lives back together. That is now signed by the governor and is in place. We got a bill passed through the session, copied from Florida and South Carolina, to reduce the regulation of private flood insurers doing business in our state, copied from Florida and South Carolina. And thirdly, we were able to get an amendment put into the budget bill that gives us $600,000 to do market conduct exams of how the companies are performing in the southwest corner of our state after Laura and Delta.
HB in Denham Springs. Hi, HB. You're on with Commissioner Donilon.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Donilon, what in the world is stopping Louisiana from having minimum liability coverage raised to cover around $100,000 due to the cost of vehicles today?
Great question. And the answer is it's the insurers who are opposed to increasing the mandated coverage limits that are in place in our state. And in fact, we did increase them about 8 years ago for the first time. When it was passed originally in 1980, it came with 10-20-10 coverage. We now have 15-30-25 as of 8 years ago. But surprising to most folks, the opposition to even mandating insurance at all comes from the insurance industry. State Farm nationwide opposes mandated automobile insurance coverage. But it's in place in 49 states, and our limits are below the national average. I totally agree that that is inadequate, but the resistance to increasing it comes from the insurance industry and those looking out for the 45% of our drivers who buy minimum limits, and it's very expensive.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Donilon. Let's have you back in a few months. We're back
thank
in a
you.
Few minutes. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. It's a pleasure to be back after a few days away. And once again, thanks to Stephanie Regal and to Julie Baxter Pair. They had some really good guests and some outstanding shows. And it's always a pleasure to share the microphone with you. And today it'll be a double pleasure because later today, 2 o'clock, we will hear from Governor John Bel Edwards. His 63rd program, 63 months without fail, he's joined us and comments on all kinds of matters, and today there are a few matters on the front page of The Advocate above the fold that are worthy of discussion with the 56th Louisiana governor. John Bel Edwards signs a bill decriminalizing pot. The law lessens penalties for small amounts of marijuana. This is historic, and we'll talk with the governor about the significance of this. The bill from Cedric Glover to decriminalize the possession of up to a half ounce of marijuana would keep parole keep people from going to jail for a drug that is legal in 17 other states. 27 states have passed similar decriminalization laws. Just a step short of legalization, takes away jail time as a penalty. So we'll talk about this with Governor Edwards. And also, as mentioned at the start of our program today, a judge has halted the president's pause on new oil and gas leases. The ruling comes on a lawsuit filed by the Attorney General of the state of Louisiana, Jeff Landry. Terry Doty is the judge that made the ruling yesterday. The lawsuit was filed in March by Jeff Landry and 12 other AGs in other states. And the governor, I'm sure, will have something to say regarding that. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email. And we're joined by Elizabeth Hinton, a Yale historian who has received plaudits for her work before today. But her latest is America on Fire, regarding the 1960s in our country. And for those who believe that we live in a treacherous country right now, and we do. We have been there before. And Dr. Hinton, it's good to share the microphone with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
Tell us about the 1960s. I was a little kid. I don't think you were even born, but it was a turbulent time in our country. And for those who weren't there, they may not appreciate the fact that we've been through some distinct challenges before contemporary issues that have evolved.
Right, of course. And, you know, the 1960s was a moment of mass mobilization and protest, demographic shifts, and, you know, what we failed to appreciate, the most sustained and largest period of domestic violence since the Civil War a century prior. There were more than 2,000 incidents of urban rebellions or civil disorder in cities across the United States, not just in the Northeast, but of course in the Southern states, in the Rust Belt and the Sun Belt, nearly all of them emerging in response to some form of police violence.
Elizabeth Hinton is an associate professor of history and African-American studies at Yale University, where she is also a professor of law. Her research is focused on poverty, racial inequality, urban violence in the 20th century. And in the late 20th century, America was an extremely violent place. And 1967 in particular, Detroit, 2 years after Watts in Los Angeles, those were times in which people lost their lives. And it shaped American life and politics. Many politicians, as we know, Richard Nixon, 1968, much of his campaign was about crime rather than Vietnam. How much of a searing moment was it for people who were living in the U.S. at that time?
Yeah, well, there was definitely, there's a sense on the one hand that the United States, coupled by the diverse protest movements, the anti-war movement, the growing student movement, and of course the civil rights and black power movements that were gaining steam in the 1960s, that, the United States was moving into a kind of period of chaos. And that was where, Richard Nixon's Law and Order kind of campaign platform really resonated with many, many Americans. But what policymakers across the political spectrum really failed to recognize was the extent to which, the violence that racked Detroit in the summer of 1967 and Newark and other cities was very much tied to the same grievances as the mainstream civil rights movement. That is, that this political violence was about full political and economic inclusion in American society, access to jobs, educational opportunities, better housing, and an end to police violence and protection against white supremacist terrorism. This is what this form of violent protests were about. And instead of addressing some of the root causes, policymakers, beginning with the Johnson administration, increasingly turned to police and surveillance and later prisons as a solution.
Well, this cycle of police violence resonates today, and you make the case in your book, America on Fire, Dr. Hinton, in many ways, what happened more than a half century ago shaped contemporary America.
Yes, I mean that decision to invest in policing and surveillance at the expense of social welfare programs has brought us that continued policy cycle has brought us to the crossroads that we face today and the enduring protests in our cities. The 1960s was really a missed opportunity, and the Kerner Commission that came out of the Detroit Rebellion in 67 recognized this and essentially recommended to the Johnson administration and policymakers at all levels of government that if they were serious about addressing the root causes of unrest and preventing it in the future, then a massive infusion of resources into low-income communities of color was necessary in the form of job creation programs, an overhaul of public housing, and expanded educational opportunities. And instead, the punitive path is where we ended up and is in many ways the most enduring legacy of Johnson's domestic policies, eventually, turning the United States into the home of the largest prison system on the planet and a mass incarceration society.
We had a number of well-known leaders who were activists in those days, and one was H.Rab Brown, who grew up just a few blocks from LSU, and he's famously remembered for saying violence is American as cherry pie. But you say in the book that black riots, and riots in quotation marks, were in fact rebellions, the police acts, or political acts, carried out in response to an unjust and repressive society. In many cases, these were peaceful, but at times they led to violence and burnings, and of course, the police responded in an even more aggressive way. Has that time and those so-called riots, have they been depicted wrongly?
Definitely. I mean, I think that was one of the misguided policy responses that, began in the 1960s that we still see today. When the first city erupted, that was of course Harlem in 1964, Lyndon Johnson immediately said, this is criminal, this has nothing to do with civil rights, it's tied to juvenile delinquency problems, and it's a riot. And thus, in response, the only to this political violence, the only solution is more policing, rather than providing basic social welfare programs and resources to communities that even the Kerner Commission recognized were the driving factors of the rebellions in the first place. The police, you know, the police encounters set them off, but they were ultimately rooted in longstanding racial inequalities and as I mentioned, you know, shared many of the same grievances and demands as the mainstream mm-hmm. civil rights movement and nonviolent direct action protests.
Now, for those who remember the 1950s, and there are people still alive who were of age in the 50s, often they speak warmly of that time as a time of peace and prosperity in our country, coming out of World War II and America feeling flexing its muscles. But underneath that, it led to the issues of the 1960s. We definitely had racism and sexism, and we just took it as a given. But ultimately, that kind of approach to life in our country would not survive indefinitely. What prompted right. it to bubble up in the 60s?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is peace and prosperity for whom? You know, for many Black Americans living in the Jim Crow South, but also in segregated and increasingly deteriorating communities in the Northeast and the West, amid, again, the continued migration of Black people in the South, leaving the white supremacist terrorist regime of Jim Crow for better opportunities in northern cities, led to a number of fiscal and demographic problems that eventually exploded in the 1960s, absent the major structural transformation that was needed. And we also know too that throughout the 1950s and even, you know, in the 20s, 30s before, I mean, you could say throughout the entire 20th century, you know, the Black Americans had mobilized and had been organizing for civil rights. And during the 1960s, you know, this long social movement took to the national stage and galvanized a broad coalition of Americans to dismantle Jim Crow finally and to fight for racial justice.
The book from Dr. Elizabeth Hinton is America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. It is a pertinent book about then and now. And Professor Hinton, a pleasure to share the microphone with you. Keep going. You're doing some good work. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll talk about Juneteenth, a celebration in our community and across this land, coming this week, as in Saturday. And we'll have a couple of guests in studio after this quick timeout on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. David Lindenfeld and Pat LaDuff, who are both active with Together Baton Rouge, are with us. And Pat is also involved in activities to try to make Scotlandville a better place. And this is a distinct time in America, and Juneteenth, short for June 19th, marks the day when federal troops arrived in Galveston in 1865, taking control of the state of Texas and ensuring that all enslaved people be free. The troops' arrival came 2.5 years after the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth honors the end of slavery in the United States, considered the longest-running African-American holiday. 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And David Lindenfeld, what's going on in Baton Rouge to commemorate this important date?
Okay, thank you for having us on. We've got a number of things, some public celebrations. The one that I'd like to talk about is kind of dispersed in local neighborhoods where this is a candlelight vigil, and we're asking people simply to take the step of lighting a candle in front of their homes, regardless of where they live, in order to say that Juneteenth really is an American holiday and it should be dispersed really throughout the city, regardless of whatever coming together we have. And I think given our divisiveness that we have at the present time, that this is a really powerful statement, because I don't know whether you saw, but the U.S. Senate unanimously voted to make Juneteenth a national holiday last night. And so I think this is we're kind of riding the crest of a wave here of saying that this is one thing that right and left can unite on, and we can demonstrate that by lighting a candle in front of our homes.
And Pat McAllister Ladoff, you've been at this a long time. This holiday, if you will, even though it's not been regarded as a major holiday, has been around for a while, but in recent years it's gained more emphasis. Why do you think it's become more prominent, and what's going to happen in Scotlandville this Saturday?
Well, we actually had our pre-Juneteenth celebration on Saturday past, and we did that with a walk and also bringing awareness to childhood obesity. So this Saturday, we will do a caravan starting at Memorial Stadium, traveling scenic over to 72nd, and then at the Juneteenth celebration, Gus Young. But we will also culminate for that prayer at 8 o'clock with the entire city, state, you know, lighting our candles. And we're hashtagging Juneteenth BR Light 2021.
Paul Annopoulos. Paul, you're on Talk Louisiana with David Lindenfeld and Pat Ladoff. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, you guys. Just a quick question on Juneteenth. When were the slaves, I should say, in Louisiana notified of the Emancipation Proclamation differ from the Texas? Thank you.
All right. How do we compare with the state of Texas as far as a continuation of slavery, even though it was no longer the law of the land?
Do you mean to what extent it was the proclamation was ignored?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a good question. I really don't have a good answer for that myself.
Well, after the war came to a close in the spring of 1865, there were 250,000 enslaved people in Texas, and emancipation didn't happen for everyone overnight. In some cases, enslavers withheld information until after the harvest season. I suspect, us being a neighboring state and traditions unfortunately being similar, we probably had issues like that in Louisiana as well.
Yeah, one interesting thing, though, is that where in parts of the South where the fighting was, a lot of slave owners actually went to Texas and took their slaves with them, so that 250,000 was a good bit more than Texas had prior to the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in
Louisiana.
Baton Rouge, right?
Baton Rouge, that's right.
Right.
That's
yeah,
right.
So you've lived an odyssey. Things are different, but in some ways things are the same, or even worse.
That's exactly right.
How is it right now?
People are coming together, and I think because of the Together Baton Rouge, Together Louisiana efforts, and other efforts, you know, but we're still separated. And so we're together, but still separated.
Gustavo in Goodwood. Gustavo, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Thank you. Good morning. Just a quick question. I'm not exactly sure who these folks are, but I'm assuming they're in a position of leadership in the community. And I have a tremendous concern for the well-being of all the communities, but especially the African-American community that has seen an incredible rise in murders, in homicides. What are they planning to do in this regard to curb that situation?
Currently, Community Against Drug and Violence is working along with Scotlandville CDC in the Scotlandville, North mm-hmm. Baton Rouge area. We are bridging that gap with the police officers, and we're also working with families with ills and mm-hmm. pressure, not to make excuses, but unemployment, you know, not having adequate housing, not having the needs that the things that you need brings extra pressure to the families. And you just walk around a walking ticking bomb. And so mm-hmm. what we're trying to do is assess and reach out and, you know, get our hands on those families that are having issues to try to resolve those issues to avoid, you know, things just happening.
877-217-5757 for Pat.
Good morning.
And if I hear Phil in Jefferson Terrace, you're also on with David Lindenfeld. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Yes, and we still have a lot of work to do. I mean, the voter suppression is very active and alive now, and it looks like Jim Crow is coming back. Anyway, I'll celebrate, and I appreciate you. Thanks.
All right. To say that Jim Crow is coming back based on what's happening regarding attempts to thwart people from voting, is that an overstatement or is that reality? David?
I think if you look at various states, I think you can definitely see an overreaction just looking at what's going on in Texas. And I think it is something. To me, looking at kind of the long term, it seems that whenever you get a kind of a surge of expression of the need for equality, you get a backlash. And you can see this even after the civil rights movement, that you could see a lot of that. And I think that's what we're seeing now, that's part of what's happening, is that people feel threatened and they don't want to give up the power and the position that they have. And it comes out in
why do they feel threatened?
Because they've been used to being in control, and that's a very hard thing to give up.
Pat?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. When you've been in control the entire time, then you want to control that. And so as African Americans rise to the top and get into leadership, it's not so great being on the other side.
Could I add a slightly more hopeful note, going back to the previous question of make things better in parts of the city in North Baton Rouge, that I think there are efforts, development efforts, to try to promote businesses in that area that both the Chamber of Commerce and others are working on. And I think that there's some hope there. I think we're coming to realize the crucial role that small businesses play, and that we're seeing that if we can promote them, that this is one way of turning some of those things around.
We only have one billionaire in the state of Louisiana. That's the lady who owns the Saints, and she inherited her wealth from her late husband, Tom Benson. Gail Benson's the person we're talking about. And yet there's this report by ProPublica in the last few days that the 25 richest people in America, many didn't pay any taxes, and those who did probably paid less of a percentage than you and I did.
That's a problem.
And many of these people are Democrats, by the way. They talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk.
That's right.
And we have this huge $28 trillion debt. When are we going to start making it an equitable country in which people who have reaped the harvest in this land pay their fair share?
When people get in leadership that want to make that happen. And so as you want to know why the fear is there of the change of leadership, is because as long as they control that, they control their wealth. And as others come on top, whether they're a Republican or a Democrat, when you get people in office that's moving towards that the average American cannot continue to carry America.
Can I say something quite specific on that issue? I've been working with Together Louisiana on Louisiana's tax structure. I've been following what's been going on in the legislature. And one thing that really concerns me about the current tax swap, even though there are a lot of good things in it, is the fact that there is a ceiling on income tax rates in the Constitution. That really puts a limit on doing the kind of thing of redistributing imbalances in wealth that we have. And I think there are a lot of good things, as I say, in that bill, but I would really think that is a very bad part of it.
Well, we'll have a discussion on that one. It's going to the vote of the people this
That's
fall,
right.
And we'll see where it goes. But
yep.
I heard Barry Irwin the other day on this show with Julie Baxter. He was extolling the virtues of it, and Barry's not a flamethrower, but we'll see. We're going to have a robust discussion, as we should, and thanks for joining us. Have a good Juneteenth. Pat McAllister Ledoff, David Lindenfeld, it's a pleasure. And we'll be back tomorrow. Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom, her husband Marvin, and their daughter Sarah will start the show with us. So awesome. Stay tuned.